In the Creekside room this afternoon, we have Tom Kennedy. Today's session number is 98.9, and it's titled Morality, Mortality. Let's listen in.
Where I do not teach literature, at least not in the English department, I teach in the philosophy department, and I've taught various courses dealing with literature and philosophy. And what I've been doing this week, or hoping we can do together this week in various sessions, is use literary texts to get at what I think are some key and important moral issues. This is the final session of that week's series. It's the final session of 2 weeks worth of teaching for me here at Holden Village, which has been 2 weeks of just delightful teaching, a wonderful experience engaging in conversation with you folks and your predecessors. So thank you very much for your involvement. Now, I need to say something about today's session, which originally was going to be the first session of this series, but turned out to be the last session. The title of today's session is Mortality, Morality, which is, I think, fairly ambiguous, and the ambiguity is not unintentional. So I do have something of an agenda and game plan, but am eager and happy for you to go in any direction which you want to go. So we'll start out going where I want to go, and then if you want to go somewhere else, well, we'll give it a try and see how that goes. So I think the way let me start this way. Initially, when I thought we would do this session, the text for the session was the short story by Isaac Dinesen called Babette's Feast. And then when I arrived at Holden, I was told, well, we've got a copy of the film up here, let's show it. So initially I wasn't presuming any familiarity with the film, but I am now curious, since the film was shown last night, I'm curious, how many of you saw the film last night or have previously seen it? Okay, so good numbers. Good numbers of us who haven't. How many of you have previously read the story? If you like the film, you should like the story a lot more. I think the story is just... I had not seen the film recently before last night, and was struck by how much better the story is than the film. Well, I think the film is a good film, but the story is so much better, I think. Well, for those of you who saw the film last night, the first thing I want to do is rehearse more or less what's going on in the film. For those of you who didn't see the film, not to worry, because this isn't presuming you did. So let me give you the structure of the story and what's going on in the story, and then we'll get to the key text and questions raised by the text. So, the name of the story, by the way, Isaac Dinesen is the author of the story, and that's actually a pen name. No, I'm not. This will sort of establish for you once and for all that I'm not in the English department, because I should know what the real name is for which is it.
Karen Blixen is the author.
Yeah, good. Can you spell that for me?
Karen, K-R-E-N. Blixen is B-L-I-X-E-N. B is in...
B-L-I-X-E-N.
Yeah.
I also wrote Out of Africa. Yeah. That's probably the other most famous story of hers. Babbitt's Feast is a short story. It's about 50 pages of very readable prose, and worth reading. It is this, first of all, let's get the characters of the story. And the characters that will be in our interest in discussing and thinking about, first of all, two sisters. And they're sisters who are daughters of the dean who was the leader of a conservative Christian group in Norway. Very conservative in the sense of otherworldly, ascetic, world-denying, not interested in the pleasures. And so he ruled the group of religious community there with quite a command. His two daughters, it was a religious community that had its roots in Lutheranism, a pietist community with roots in Lutheranism. And so, not too surprisingly, or maybe still surprisingly given that, his daughters' names are Martina, after Martin Luther, and Philippa, after Luther's friend and successor, Philip Melanchthon. Those are two key characters. Other two characters that are critical in the book, Lawrence Lowenheim and Akil Papin, and finally Babette, whose last name again I forgot.
That's all right.
Lawrence Lowenheim is a military figure initially who rises in society, becomes something of a society figure as well. Akil Papin is a Paris opera singer. Finally, Babette. And Babette's the most mysterious figure in the story. Some of that mystery is not revealed in the movie as it is in the book. I think she doesn't come off as quite as mysterious in the film as she actually is in the story. Babette is a refugee from revolutionary activity in France. She's had to leave France because of her connection with certain types of revolutionary activity. Her husband was executed, her son was executed in response to suppressing that revolutionary activity. She herself has been accused of making petroleum bombs and throwing them at houses.
In the time frame?
About 1870, 1871 is when that revolutionary activity is taking place. When we first meet Babette, all we know is what we're told in a letter from Akil Papin about her. And rather cryptically, he writes, "She can cook." By the end of the story of the film, is one of the greatest understatements from this. Well, how does the story go, or the story to the extent that we want to attend to it? And for most of our time today, I'm just going to bracket the feast. That should strike you as a very peculiar thing. I mean, after all, the title of the story is Babette's Feast. Everything builds up to the feast. But I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the feast itself. It's worth reading the story to see what's going on there. But here's how the story goes, more or less. The two daughters, Martina and Philippa, are women of extraordinary, young women of extraordinary beauty when we first meet them. We're told that everyone finds them striking. Young men can't take their eyes off them. But it becomes clear that it's not just physical beauty, that's a part of what's going on. But in the two daughters, Martina and Philippa, there is an inner beauty that corresponds to that outer beauty, or in part the inner beauty is what makes the outer beauty so impressive and strong. There's a beauty of soul, perhaps, which affects people as much as the physical beauty. And so already, when we first meet Martina and Philippa, I think we see a sort of blending of two different worlds, a blending of the visual, physical world intermingled with a spiritual, how else to put it, beauty of soul type of world that's present in those two people. And so there's something of irony there that these young women are women who belong to a religious group which is unworldly, which thinks things associated with visual beauty, pleasures of the senses generally are to be renounced. And yet what one sees in the two daughters is that despite the fact that this is a community which wants to renounce, for the sake of religion and fidelity to God and Jesus, wants to renounce pleasures of the flesh, nevertheless, as evident in these two daughters, the flesh itself conveys a spiritual, a deeper beauty. Now that raises one of the first questions I'd like us to think a bit about. Whether this whole idea of beauty of soul makes any sense to us. I mean, obviously physical beauty does make sense to us. We have no beautiful people. Does the idea of having a beautiful soul, does that make sense to you? And do you think there's any connection between having a beautiful soul and physical beauty, or physical beauty and having a beautiful soul? Is that an abstract enough question for you to get you going?
I guess that thought that strikes me is about a year ago when both Princess Diana and Mother Teresa died, and there was this wonderful photo of the two of them together, I think at the one time in their lives that they both met. But, you know, I think that the coming together in that photo of the two of them is so striking, and it's kind of haunted me for the past year. Mm-hmm.
What did you find so striking about it? What was it about the two of them together?
I think that the physical beauty that the world has held up in Princess Diana clearly is not present in Mother Teresa, but there is a beauty of soul there that Princess Diana can never, or would never have achieved probably in her lifetime. Oh, mm-hmm. I don't know about that, I guess. But possibly never have achieved. Mm-hmm. And here's this shriveled woman in her habit and standing beside this tall, supposedly elegant, have-it-all kind of person. Mm-hmm. And yet the contrast was just so striking, and yet there was a sense of beauty about that photo that brought the two together in a way that, that struck me very deeply.
Mm-hmm. Do you think our appearances can tell people about our character, that somehow how we look, how we appear to others, conveys who we really are?
Well, I think, well, it could in a way. Like, if you spend a long time on your image and everything, well, you can tell that the person spent, and I mean, it looks like that. Really, like, a lot of whatever.
So
you can tell that they're either, you can tell a little bit, but.
Okay, at least in some sense, then, we can tell people who work a whole lot on image, and that tells us something about a character or a person. Maybe it tells us that the person's spending too much time on something that's not really important. That's something about character. Anything more than that?
There's also that aspect of, and I didn't see the film, but I studied film. A lot of the times, a character will not be beautiful or seem beautiful, but as you see that character develop and as the camera follows them, mostly through closer shots, they become beautiful through their works. And that's often, thinking that, that maybe that's what created, that kind of showed the mystery of her, that maybe through the end she became much more attractive and much more beautiful than she was in the beginning. And therefore, you feel that you are starting to know that person, and therefore they become beautiful visually to you because of that. Often when you see somebody that's beautiful, you automatically have them stereotyped and assumed to be one type of person through the way that they look, not knowing what's going on with them on the inside.
Do you think we're trying to expand this whole idea. Do you think we expect ugly people, that ugliness is attached to character in such a way that typically we expect ugliness to display or to disclose that the person there really is not just physically ugly, but there's also an ugly character as well?
There's
a
whole
work on both ends, or is it just...
It has always struck me as very unfair that oftentimes the people you'll see in jail will be quite ugly, and you often wonder what the correlation is, that people didn't give them a chance because they had a weak chin and they couldn't get a job and people didn't like them and people didn't want to be their friends and they got in with the wrong crowd. You kind of wonder if maybe because they were not good looking, they ended up going down a path that wasn't really where they would have gone if they had been better looking.
But I also think that a continual expression on the face and an outlook on life can over the years mold that face. Mm-hmm. And that a person who looks at the world with a bit of a scowl will eventually appear ugly. And so to some degree, the laugh lines around some people's faces make us find them more attractive, and the continual scowl on another face does make us think, no, I'm not sure that that's the person I want to get to know.
If you want to read a story, a short novel, that really explores this in a wonderful way, you've seen a version of the movie, no doubt, but Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. In her telling of that story, that's one of the things she's really interested in trying to get a handle on, how this is all going on. Because when Victor Frankenstein creates the monster, I mean, the first striking thing about the monster is that, well, the monster is utterly ugly and repulsive, but the monster has a good heart initially. So what happens, Shelley explores as the story goes on, is that what happens is the monster becomes corrupt and evil as a result of people finding that monster repulsive. The monster starts doing violence precisely because people respond to it in such a negative way because of its ugliness.
Well, maybe that goes on what she was saying about people in jail. That's the initial response.
But some of the least attractive people you meet, someone you just feel good after you speak to them. Mm-hmm. Their beautiful insight. Firmly believe that. I've met a lot of people, and some of them, you just know it. They're just nice. They're great. That has nothing to do with.
In the case of Mother Teresa, I mean, that's certainly someone who, in terms of physical beauty, hard to see. And even if you look at old pictures, hard to see. But there is always, I mean, for some reason, it's hard not to see through that physical beauty, to see the person who's really.
But you don't even, sometimes you meet people, you know, just meet them casually. And if you walk away from them, you feel, gee, what a nice person it was. Mm-hmm. You know, he is so special.
What about Abraham Lincoln? There are probably lots of famous people who did a lot of good and didn't look that good.
I work with handicapped children, and one of the things that we sometimes know is that the rejection that they experience in the playground because they are different, maybe not terribly physically different, but different in other ways, begins to shape what we call secondary disabilities, which are the social problems that they develop, sometimes in retaliation for the rejection or the teasing or the whatever else they encounter that's so negative. So I do think that there is that element to it. Mm-hmm. And in that story, at least as it was depicted in the movie, and I haven't read the story itself, I think one of the things that struck me was that although the Martinique and Philippa's beauty faded over time, their souls were very good, but there was a sense of frustration because of that lack of joy in their life. Mm-hmm. They didn't have an opportunity to experience the joy of the Lord. And so in some ways, mm-hmm. they became sort of hardened Christians.
See, I think if you read the story, I don't think Isaac Neeson wants you to think there's any lack of joy in their lives. It's a different type of joy, perhaps, maybe expressed in a different way. But I don't think she wants you to think that there's a deficiency in their life, that if they had chosen differently or lived in a different way, they would be more fulfilled. I think what she wants you to think is that there's a beauty of soul that's present in them from those earliest stages, and that is carried with them through those later stages. So that there's a sense in which when we see them as older women, in which they're just as beautiful, just as striking, because of that beauty of soul, as they were when they were younger. I think that's her...
Also, I think that, personally, sometimes, if someone looks like they spend a lot of time on their physical beauty, it makes me seem a little hesitant to get to know them,
mm-hmm.
just at least for me, because it's sometimes I feel like that, the people who don't look so good tend to sometimes be nicer because maybe other people won't talk to them right off, and so they have.
Yeah, there probably is, I haven't thought a lot about this, there probably is some sort of standard when people get too beautiful, when we think they're too beautiful, it's off-putting to us. And we keep them at arm's length. So there's a certain range of attractiveness which we find welcoming and friendly. Go beyond that and probably the same thing at both ends of the spectrum. Well, back to the story. What's happening? In the story, there is this opera singer from Paris, Achille Papin, who is seeking a quiet place. He's front and center in Paris, very famous, very popular. He's achieved a lot, but he needs a quiet place to rest. And so as he's performing there in Scandinavia, he asks a friend, where can I go for quietness? And they recommend the region close to where Martina and Philippa live. While he is there wandering along the cliffs, suddenly his thoughts turn to his own mortality. He's going to grow older, and he's not going to be as successful on the stage in Paris. And he becomes melancholy and finds it all gloomy. To rid himself of his melancholy, he goes into the village, hears a church service and singing in the church service, enters the church service, sits down, and hears one of the most beautiful voices that he's ever heard. And it's Philippa singing. After the service, he follows them, learns that it's the dean's daughter, sends a letter, goes and meets the dean and says, I'd like to give your, here's, I'm an opera singer, I'd like to give your daughter voice lessons. Is that all right with you? And perhaps if you saw the movie, you may not have observed this, but he is so transported already by the beauty of her voice that he's, in a sense, lost control of what he's saying. And so he's careless in some of his answers. So the dean of the group says, well, are you a papist? Are you a Roman Catholic? And Papin doesn't give him the cautious, careful answer. He says, well, yeah, of course. Dumb thing. But that's sort of how he's been transformed by the beauty of Philip. That the suggestion is that there are experiences of beauty we have in the world which change, which somehow leave us without control of ourselves. They begin singing lessons. He begins singing lessons with Philippa. And he starts, as they sing and as he's struck every time with the beauty of her voice, he starts talking with her about a career that she can have with him there in Paris. Now again, part of the story behind this is he looks forward to his future life and it looks gloomy to him. He's going to get old. And she's brought new life to him. And now he has hopes for his future by means of Philippa.
He's also singing from Don Giovanni.
Yeah, that's
it. Yeah, I thought that was
And that's a passage I'm going to read real briefly, the last part of that, which that's described in the text. So again, the description of him being transported and lost while singing with Philippa. The teacher now gave his pupil the part of Zerlina in Mozart's opera Don Giovanni to study. He himself, as often before, sang Don Giovanni's part. So you've got this passionate, romantic duo. He had never in his life sung as now. In the duet of the second act, which is called the Seduction Duet, he was swept off his feet by the heavenly music and the heavenly voices. As the last melting note died away, he seized Philippa's hands, drew her toward him, and kissed her solemnly, as a bridegroom might kiss his bride before the altar. Then he let her go, for the moment was too sublime for any further words or movement. Mozart himself was looking down on the two. What happens is that Philippa, who knows that the religious community is depending upon her staying there and working there, finds this all a bit much. Finally, she'd never confided in anyone else that he'd been talking about this career in Paris. But this is too much. It's all too earthy, too fleshly. So she tells her father, I think I've finished the singing lessons. Please send him away. And Papin leaves the area brokenhearted and returns to Paris. He is the one who sends Babette back, sends Babette when she's fleeing from Paris, sends her to stay with these two sisters. And when he sends her to stay with these two sisters, he sends a letter with her describing who she is. And at the end of the letter, he starts reflecting. Now, this has been 15, 20 years at least from when she was there, when he was there earlier. He's describing then, after he's described who she is, he reflects a bit on what his life has been like since he left brokenhearted from the community, how things have ended up for him. He writes, I envy Babette in her despair. She is to see your faces. As you receive her mercifully, send a merciful thought back to France. For 15 years, Miss Philippa, I have grieved that your voice should never fill the Grand Opera of Paris. When tonight I think of you, no doubt surrounded by a gay and loving family, and of myself, gray, lonely, forgotten by those who once applauded and adored me, I feel that you may have chosen the better part in life. What is fame? What is glory? The grave awaits us all. And yet, my lost Zerlina, and yet, soprano of the snow, as I write this, I feel that the grave is not the end. In paradise, I shall hear your voice again. There you will sing without fears or scruples, as God meant you to sing. There you will be the great artist that God meant you to be. Ah, how you will enchant the angels. And you'll hear those words later in the film or later in the story. Those are words which actually Philippa will speak to Babette at the end of the story. So the irony here is this, that Papin, who is Mr. Worldly, the sage in Paris, who has embodied and expressed and experience the greatest of sensual pleasures in the Parisian opera. Here he's at a stage in which he says, but why should I think that was the right choice? It's the grave awaits us all. What is fame? What is glory? So envying the simplicity, although he's mistaken, actually, isn't he, about the existence of Philippa and Martina? Yeah. There's not a gay and loving family. There's no way you call it gay happy family. That's not what it is. If it's joyous, as I think it is, it's a very simple, low level type of joy, a joy that comes from service.
And she's hardly surrounded by a happy family. She's a grumpy parishioner.
Well, that's right. Yeah. The members of the religious group are, as they have aged, they've grown more bitter and angry and quarrelsome with one another. And that is her family. It's the religious community that is their family. So quite right. She hasn't at all ended up the way he thinks she will have ended up. So he wonders about that. Well, the other character, Lawrence Lohenheim, and he's the one I want us to spend a bit more time on initially. The first time we meet him, he's a young, reckless military officer. He's been spending his time gambling, and he's now indebted to many people. And he's in so much trouble, he's embarrassing the family. And so his father says, Lawrence, we got to do something about this. I'm packing you off to my very pious sister who lives in the middle of nowhere. And you're going to have a lot of time to meditate about how your life just isn't what it ought to be. So spend some time there and get your act together, mend your ways. And so that's when we first meet Lawrence Lohenheim. He has just visited the village, and he has just, for the first time, set his eyes upon Martina in the marketplace. He looked down at the pretty girl, and she looked up at the fine horseman. When she had passed him and disappeared, he was not certain whether he was to believe his own eyes. Young Lawrence, had not been aware of any particular spiritual gift in his own nature. But at this one moment, there rose before his eyes a sudden mighty vision of a higher and purer life, with no creditors, dunning letters, or parental lectures, with no secret unpleasant pangs of conscience, and with a gentle golden-haired angel to guide and reward him. So having seen her beauty, suddenly he longs for a better, purer life himself. Through his pious aunt, he got admission to the dean's house and saw that Martina was even lovelier without a bonnet. He followed her slim figure with adoring eyes, but he loathed and despised the figure which he himself cut in her nearness. He was amazed and shocked by the fact that he could find nothing at all to say, and no inspiration in the glass of water before him. Mercy and truth, dear brethren, have met together, said the dean. Righteousness and bliss have kissed one another. And the young man's thoughts were with the moment when Lawrence and Martine should be kissing each other. He repeated his visit time after time, and each time he visited, he seemed to himself to grow smaller and more insignificant and more contemptible. When in the evening he came back to his aunt's house, he kicked his shining riding boots to the corners of his room, even laid his head on the table and wept. On the last day of his stay, he made a last attempt to communicate his feelings to Martina. Till now, it had been easy for him to tell a pretty girl that he loved her. But the tender words stuck in his throat as he looked into this maiden's face. When he had said goodbye to the party, Martina saw him to the door with a candlestick in her hand. The light shone on her mouth and threw upwards the shadows of her long eyelashes. He was about to leave in dumb despair when on the threshold he suddenly seized her hand and pressed it to his lips. I'm going away forever, he cried. I shall never, never see you again. For I have learned here that fate is hard, and that in this world there are things which are impossible. What? Does that make any sense to you? What's going on there? What seems to be... Why does he leave in this way? Why does he... He's saying, I'm going away, I'll never see you again. I've learned here that fate is hard, and that in this world there are things which are impossible. What's impossible?
That was not clear to me in the film that I saw last night. All I can think of is he wasn't worthy of her, and he sort of understood that. But I didn't understand what his reluctance was.
I think it was just shame that he realized, confronted by such piety, what he'd been told by his father and other people, I guess, before. But he realized that he had lived his life in a way that did not meet the standards of that community, and realized that because of those decisions that fate would keep them apart.
Aristotle, the philosopher Aristotle, says at one point in talking about friendship, Aristotle says, here's a deep truth about friendship. Two people of significantly different character cannot really be friends. It can't happen. You're not going to have any sort of genuine friendship between two people of significantly different character. If one's a lot better than the other, or one's a lot worse than the other, either way, you cannot have a real friendship. Do you think that's true? That seems to be what Lawrence is saying. Whenever I'm around you, I can't speak. I'm so daunted by your goodness and beauty. My tongue gets tied up. Whenever I'm around you, I feel small and contemptible. You are, in terms of relative goodness, you are just so much better than I am. Here's the impossibility that either one of us could ever be happy, given the differences in our moral quality and moral character.
Well, he was also concerned about his career and marrying in the wrong circles was not of his own style.
Yeah. I think that's right, though. Let's see. My reading of the story up to this point is that his concern about his career is his way of addressing or getting around his feeling of shame and contempt for himself in her presence. So the story goes on. And by the way, this idea, it's interesting. I don't know whether this is a different in some historical periods, or whether this, I'm not from a Scandinavian background, and some of you no doubt are, and so maybe you can clue me in on this. One of the most famous historical philosophical events had to do with the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, Kierkegaard, K-I-E-R-K-E-G-A-A-R-D. And Kierkegaard, exactly this sort of thing. He was engaged at one point to a young woman named Regina Olsen. Apparently loved her very deeply, and she loved him. They were to be married, and finally he breaks it off abruptly, really with no explanation. Very bizarre thing. And so far as we can make out, it looks like his grounds for breaking off the relationship was he had concluded that she would just be terribly unhappy with someone like him the rest of her life. And so that's his way of dealing. Well,
I forget from the movie, did Martine reciprocate Lauren's attraction or not?
We don't know. I mean, I think there's reason to think that it's, as with Philippa, that she finds, I mean, there's attraction in both cases, but also in both cases, there is an otherworldliness that they're struggling with, but their first fidelity is to this religious community.
Well, because there was in the movie, there was also the scene a while later where Philippa was asking her, did she ever think about the writer?
Yes.
And she says, you know, kind of a, and her look and so on.
Yeah.
And the yes said yeah. There was some attraction.
Yeah. Yeah. It's told in the story, the question is asked, but it's asked in a much more commonplace way, more, whatever happened to that guy. But yeah, well, on with Lorenz Loewenheim. When he was once more back in his garrison town, he thought his adventure over. So he's left the community, he's gone back to his military group. He thought his adventure over and found that he didn't like to think of it at all. While the other young officers talked of their love affairs, he was silent on his. For seeing from the officers' mess, and so to say with its eyes, it was a pitiful business. How had it come to pass that a lieutenant of the Hussars had let himself be defeated and frustrated by a set of long-faced sectarians in the bare-floored rooms of an old dean's house? Now he's feeling embarrassed about it all. Earlier it was shame he felt, and now it's embarrassment. He didn't win. Then he became afraid. Panic fell upon him. Was it the family madness which made him still carry with him the dreamlike picture of a maiden so fair that she made the air around her shine with purity and holiness? He did not want to be a dreamer. He wanted to be like his brother officers. So he pulled himself together and in the greatest effort of his young life made up his mind to forget what had happened to him in Berlevoy. From now on, he resolved he would look forward, not back. He would concentrate on his career, and the day was to come when he would cut a brilliant figure in a brilliant world. So he's done with the wildness of his youth. But now he's going to prove to himself that he is somebody and that he made the right decision walking away from Martina. His mother was pleased with the result of his visit to Fossum, and in her letters expressed her gratitude to his aunt. She did not know by what queer winding roads her son had reached his happy moral standpoint. And he does become successful and famous. Uses his familiarity with the religious language to endear himself to the queen's attachés or those who are attached to the queen, and marries a high society person and flourishes, or so we're led to think. Later in his life, he comes back to visit. And this is at the time that, incidentally, as Babette is preparing the feast. So he comes back to visit his aunt. He he's a successful person at this point. We would have every reason to believe, looking at him, he appears eminently successful. And so it's some risk. If this were not such wonderful writing, I wouldn't dare to read as long a passage as this, but I think it's great stuff. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoy reading. General Lohenheim had been driving from Fossum to Berlevog in a strange mood. He had not visited this part of the country for 30 years. He had come now to get a rest from his busy life at court, but he had found no rest. The old house of Fossum was peaceful enough and seemed somehow pathetically small after the Tuileries, the gardens in Paris, and the Winter Palace. But the old house in Fossum held one disquieting figure. Young Lieutenant Lohenheim walked in its rooms. So the film tried to show this. But so wherever he goes and he walks through this house, he sees himself as a young man. And that's what causes this conflict, this wrestling. General Lohenheim saw the handsome, slim figure pass close by him. And as he passed, the boy gave the elder man a short glance and a smile, the haughty, arrogant smile which youth gives to age. The general might have smiled back, kindly and old sadly, as age smiles at youth, if it had not been that he was really in no mood to smile. He was, as his aunt had written, in low spirits. So what's the internal conflict that's going on for General Lohenheim now?
What if?
Okay, what are the what ifs in question?
What if he hadn't gone on to do his military career instead?
Yeah, okay, so it's the what ifs are partly, you've made a lot, the young man looks at him and says, well, you've made a lot of yourself, but so what? Why are you any better than if, as I take it, either you had stayed the reckless gambler, or instead of turning away from Martina, had somehow found a way to stay here with her. So I think a sense in which the young Lohenheim says, to the old Lohenheim, you had two choices then. You took neither one of them. What's so great about your life now?
Or is it showing that he's coming back to a point where he had started from, in the sense that he is realizing his life, he's done the same thing as he was when he was younger. The actions are different, but he is still back to the same exact point of being depressed with himself and not... feeling, to me, what you said before was he never felt any self-worth about himself, no pride in what he was doing, and even though now he's done supposedly what society thinks is all of this wonderful stuff, he still isn't fulfilled by it.
Yeah.
The only thing that it sounds like he was fulfilled by was aspiring to be like Martine. I don't know if he probably loved her, but more loved her in admiration type of way, rather than really passionately loving her.
Beauty of soul. He's so overwhelmed by her beauty of soul.
Yeah, wanting to be like her, to have you know, to encompass that kind of that happiness and radiating that same, you know, type of thing that Martine is. He was so scared by that he ran away from it.
Yeah.
And twice in his life now, he's back to the same spot, realizing I've run away from this, and this is really where I should have been.
Yeah.
It's his crossroads.
Yeah.
I think he's sort of like Pan earlier. He's come back to the point now he's sort of contemplating his own mortality.
Yeah,
yeah, I was going to say that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get a bit more of that as I read on here. General Lohenheim had obtained everything that he had striven for in life, and was admired and envied by everyone.
Which is just like Papin at the time
that
he first visited.
Yeah. Only he himself knew of a queer fact which jarred with his prosperous existence, that he was not perfectly happy. Something was wrong somewhere. And he carefully felt his mental self all over. as one feels a finger over to determine the place of a deep-seated invisible thorn. He was in high favor with royalty. He had done well in his calling. He had friends everywhere. The thorn sat in none of these places. His wife was a brilliant woman and still good-looking. Perhaps she neglected her own house a little for her visits and parties. She changed her servants every 3 months, and the general's meals at home were served unpunctually. The general, who valued good food highly in life, here felt a slight bitterness against the lady and secretly blamed her for the indigestion from which he sometimes suffered. Still, the thorn was not here either. Nay, but an absurd thing had lately been happening to General Lohenheim. He would find himself worrying about his immortal soul. Did he have any reason for doing so? He was a moral person, loyal to his king, his wife, and his friends, an example to everybody. But there were moments when it seemed to him that the world was not a moral, but a mystic concern. He looked into the mirror, examined the row of decorations on his breast, and sighed to himself, "Vanity, vanity, all is vanity." Oh. What are we to do with Lohenheim here? But there were moments when it seemed to him that the world was not a moral, but a mystic concern. What's the contrast he has in mind? What's the difference between the world being a moral concern and a mystic concern? Is it a mystic concern rather than a moral concern? Or is it both? Or is it neither?
I think he's talking about the fact that he's done everything right. He's been a correct person. But the thing that he's seeing in these women or that he remembers, it is a more magical thing, and it's more elusive, and you can't get there by just doing all the right things. It's at a different level than correct behavior.
And sometimes your imagination is always better than reality, too. You know, if you imagine how it could have been, it never would have been like that if it had been in reality.
Yeah. I mean, is he wrong? Isn't he just wrong? I mean, I seem to remember, now one never knows how accurate one's memory is, but I seem to remember from my youth being told that goodness is its own reward. And so now here is Lohenheim, who has been good by any reasonable standards. He's been good, hasn't he? And yet his suggestion seems to be that, well, it's not very rewarding.
You know, I guess what strikes me is that he is very disillusioned by, apparently, his own moral fiber, although he's got all the decorations and done all the right things. But if you listen to the mystical community that surrounded the two of them, the dean's family, they were hardly good and moral people in many ways. You know, they admitted to their own sins and unrighteousness. And so, to some degree, what he was seeing was merely the outer surface of those people, and that they really did have admissions of greater guilt and admissions of sin that they were willing to at least share with each other. Yeah. So to some degree, probably, I think the definition between moral and mystical is the definition between a relationship with God or no relationship with God. That their joy came from their relationship with God, even though they had done naughty things to one another along the way. And so they had a sense of peace about their salvation that he didn't find because he had merely done the good things, mm-hmm. but had not had that relationship.
Okay, so your reading is that here's the contrast we ought to be making, the contrast between a moral life but not enough religious interest or commitment. And a religious life, even though filled with moral shortcomings, that there's a sense of which the deeper one, the one that provides more fulfillment, will be the religious life, even with its moral shortcomings. Is that... Do we see Martina and Philippa confessing their shortcomings or their faults? Ever?
I thought it was confessed in the end when she hugged Babette. That, you know, I didn't live my life with enough joy. And thank you for bringing that to us. And I bless you because of the joy you brought us.
Has Philippa made a serious mistake with her life? Or at the ending scene, she does say to Babette, she uses the language of the great artist, exact words that Papine had written to her, that said, this life is not the whole story. You're going to be able to practice your art in paradise, and you will enchant the angels, exactly what Papine had said to her. Do you think that's an admission of her, I made the wrong choice? Or, it seems to me there's one way of reading the story that suggests, well, the choices don't really matter.
That's right.
That you're going to choose one way or another. If you saw the film or if you read the story, there's the scene in which Lohenheim speaks at the feast. And basically, Lohenheim says, I've learned here tonight, in eating this marvelous food that Babette has prepared for us, I've learned here tonight that anything is possible, contrary to what I said as a young man. Anything is possible. Grace is infinite. It knows no bounds. And because of that, choices seem insignificant. The question, the book, the story, and the film seem to me to raise is the question, how should we think about morality in the moral life? How serious should we be about forming ourselves, being a certain sort of person? How much does this life matter? I'm not sure about the answer it gives. I'm not sure it gives a very clear answer other than suggesting that the one thing you've got to grasp clearly is that insofar as you try to keep separate the physical world in which we live and a deeper beauty, moral or spiritual, that insofar as you try to keep those two realms separate, you'll be making a mistake. And what you learn from Babette's feast is that spiritual moral beauty is intrinsically connected with physical sensual beauty. And the way to live one's life is to turn against neither of those. That if you live a life of physical and sensual beauty, turning away from spiritual moral beauty, you really won't accomplish the pleasures that are possible in this life. And by contrast, if you try to focus on moral beauty, as Lohenheim did, or perhaps even spiritual beauty, as the two sisters did, you'll have missed something important about the goodness of life, as can be seen in the feast in which they suffered that night. Well, our time is up, and I sort of feel like we're closing on a whimper rather than a bang. We have to close some way. So thank you for your attention and participation and good comments.
Was a good summary.
And again, I know